Hi, and welcome to the Safety Pro Roundtable Podcast. My name is Stacey Godbold, and I will be your host. I've always loved hearing people talk about challenges they have faced and how they have moved through it, as well as hearing different perspectives. So as a result, on this show, I am bringing you roundtable discussions with safety pros, safety consultants, and even executives of organizations as we talk about updates and the challenges in the ever-changing safety industry. Stacey Godbold here with SOS, the Safety Roundtable Podcast, and I'm here with Jim Blair. I'm so happy to meet you finally virtually.
Nice to meet you, Stacey.
Thank you. So tell me the name of your company.
We are called Integrated Risk Management Solutions. We're a LLC. We provide consulting services globally to all sizes, shapes, and forms of organizations, profit, nonprofit, large and small.
Okay, so just a few minutes off of the mic here, you said that you were a risk nerd. Is that something that you just have claimed for yourself?
No, I've actually been accused of that by clients more than anybody else.
Okay, so in the lens of manufacturing, we'll just kind of stick with the lens of manufacturing if that's okay.
Sure.
Or kind of in that process-oriented organization. You do risk analysis, correct? And we're talking a lot to that safety pro. Who typically gets in touch with you to come in and do that risk analysis?
It's usually the CFO. Or the chief operating officer, and in some cases, the CEO. I have been engaged by boards before. And so in America, we intentionally take risk to make money. So we take risk to generate cash. If we don't manage risk well, we spend cash. It's one of the prime themes of my organization's approach is, risk equals cash. And so if you think about the elements around safety, whether you're large or small, we have a number of regulated requirements to practice safety practices. It's called duty of care, and it's an actual legal requirement that sits on the shoulders of every single organization in America. We have the responsibility to maintain a healthy and safe work environment for our employees and for our customers and for our suppliers and for visitors and anybody else that is in our workplace. And so not very many of the folks I talk to really comprehend that the federal government requires it, but we do. But the other element about safety is, and why it's important, is that we want to run an effective business. And in order to do that, we have employees. And if those employees cannot function practically and efficiently, or they're not on the job because of a safety issue, we're not operating at our optimum capacity. And so the tendency is that we invest dollars in safe practices and safe performance, not only for the purpose of maintaining optimal performance of our employee work base, but also because it's a regulatory requirement, in addition to OSHA and state regulations and all those kinds of things. But it's really a very selfish outlook, and that is we're going to spend money so that we can optimize our return going forward. That's why it keeps going back to the theme of risk equals cash.
So when you have a risk manager and a safety manager, do those two typically get along? I didn't think so.
No.
Why is that? Because shouldn't they be synonymous and run parallel?
Yes, they should.
Okay.
But we have this terrible bad habit in particularly corporate America, and I'll pick on us just because, to put those two functions in different silos. And so very often the risk manager might be off reporting to Treasury or someplace in finance, or often the law department or a compliance department, because risk management is viewed as compliance, which is a misnomer to start with. The risk manager ought to be the most proactive human being on the planet, trying to make sure that the organization is running as effectively as it can. And that eventually reduces costs, it reduces premiums, it reduces claims, and it improves the reputation of the business. Now, the safety person typically reports up through operations. And it's not that they don't care for each other, but anytime organizations have silos, we immediately plant miscommunications, absence of communications, lack of alignment in terms of goals and objectives. And so our mantra in the integrated risk management world that I think Tom appreciated so much is that management of risk is done by a governance team. And either one of those people could lead it. One could lead it for a quarter and another one could lead it for another quarter. It really doesn't matter. But it is every organization is at the table with a leadership-oriented decision maker, and they are collectively evaluating risks, designing mitigation programs to optimize the business. And by the way, there's a charter that's actually written by the CEO that says, that's what I'm expecting you to do.
Okay, so how can they start? I mean, well, I guess I should ask the question, is it a good idea for these two to start working together?
Very much so. And it isn't just those two. I mean, it's the, you know, it's all the other organizations that impact risk in the business. And that includes compliance. In this day and age, it very much includes security and cybersecurity, both of which are moderately connected to safety. So they easily could be in the same shop other than the, you know, the brain of an IT security person is not the brain of a physical safety person, but yet both of them have impact and influence on the duty of care responsibility to the business.
That's a really great analogy. That's, yeah, I appreciate that. So is there a way, well, okay, the safety pro, is there a place for them to grow professionally by getting involved in the risk lane?
Well, so the answer is yes. But historically, we don't really look at them like that. Now, if we put the hat on that says we're going to invest a risk dollar and expect a return, then all of a sudden you've turned that safety professional into a business leader rather than just practicing whatever the OSHA rules might be or whatever the company safety manual says. I mean, that gives you kind of a myopic view. It says, I'm supposed to get people trained. I'm supposed to make sure they get trained. And then I'm going to measure their performance. And if they have a problem, that's when I step in and they, you know, they call me to help come fix it. And that is a different kind of an outlook than a growing professional ought to have. They ought to be looking at, again, how you optimize the business by making sure the employees are healthy and productive and on the job. And actually, they become enablers to the working employee who begins to believe that safety manager believes in my safety and my health. And so it's not only what's going on the job, it's all the health and safety that we practice off the job. Because quite frankly, if you're a machinist and you sprain your ankle playing basketball with your kids, you aren't any good at the office. And so safety goes well beyond it. And to me, it's a great responsibility for safety professionals to think globally about the employee and the entire family.
So if you could create an org chart for the perfect, you know, the perfect org chart in an organization, what would that look like?
Well, so it is a risk governance team because risk management is everybody's business and it is a team sport and it needs to be looked at that way. My preference is that team would report to the CEO. And they can be in their silos. They can be in their own organizations if that's where comfort resides. But the point is that on a rhythmic, regular basis, that team works together as one. And one, they identify risks, usually that would have a material impact or could have a material impact on the business. They determine and decide and recommend mitigation strategies to take on those risks. They measure the performance and the outcome. They resolve disputes, because there are always disputes between organizations, and they help resolve priorities, but they have a pipeline to the top. And of course, the top is the CEO, and perhaps in some cases the board, but it is not some director of safety or security in some department. So that's the ideal. And the benefit of it, Stacy, is they don't have to leave their home departments. Right. They are simply directed and designed to operate as a team. Now, there are some parts of the organization we haven't talked about. One is human resources, ought to be part of the team. Legal needs to be part of the team. Compliance needs to be part of the team. Who's ever in responsibility for business continuity and emergency preparedness and response needs to be on the team. And then certainly marketing needs to be on the team, because there's messaging that needs to occur. And then in addition to safety and security and the new world of cybersecurity.
So it sounds like as a safety professional, you wouldn't necessarily go into that lane. It's just absorbing some of that thought process, responsibility, and being a part of the risk team, but not necessarily walking into that lane, staying in their lane, but assuming maybe more understanding.
Well, it's an expansion of what ought to happen when they walk into that lane.
Okay.
And so certainly an interest and an excitement and a passion about safety is a wonderful thing. And not everybody's cut out that way. But in the ideal organization, they're on that job for a month, and the boss is going to come and say, all right, I got 20% of you that's supposed to go pay attention to this team. Because each member of the team that I just described helps and enables the success of the other. I mean, effective human resources management has a direct impact on the safety performance of employees. Cyber and security has equal impact. I mean, doggone it, if the doors can't be locked at 9 o'clock at night when it's dark outside and bad people are running around, you're not providing a safe work environment. And most safety professionals would say, well, that's not my job, that's security. But safety is everybody's job. And that's a culture, that's a philosophy that unfortunately, too many clients who I walk into the front doors of don't have that in place until I'm finished with them.
When I'm finished with you. So, Jim, whenever you said that the C-suite calls you and they want a risk assessment, right? And is safety a part of that conversation typically, or is that something that you have to bring into the conversation?
No, it's very much part of the conversation. But I don't start from the bottom. I start from the top in those kinds of analysis. The first thing that we do is establish what their material financial measurement is. You know, if you're a public company in the United States, it's a penny a share. And so if you have an impact or you anticipate an impact of a penny a share, you need to report that via the 8K to the Securities and Exchange Commission every quarter. Now, if you're a private business, it's up to the CFO and the CEO to figure that out, but they usually come up with 1% of revenue. Now, the conversation that I have with every single leader of the business is, let's simply talk about the risks that you're aware of with your expertise that could cause a material penny a share impact in 90 days. Now, that's an entirely different conversation than, are you following all the safety rules? But a incident, which we unfortunately in the United States are now becoming more used to, of a wildfire, of a heavy windstorm, of floods, that indeed could shut down a plant, that's certainly a material impact and impacts a ton of the employees' health and well-being. COVID's a great example. You know, the shutdown of our meat plants and our education facilities and churches and all that kind of stuff. Those were all material impacts, some of which we might have been able to prevent, some of which we might not. In that case, time was our enemy. Because, you know, the bad virus shows up and nobody knows what we're looking at. And it's not like somebody's at fault. But we did see and we did witness cases where management simply did not react and respond as quickly as they should.
So before we wrap up, I would like you to get your storytelling hat on. I would love to hear a story about your favorite customer, your favorite client, and I guess why it was your favorite. You know, if there was like a big shift in culture or a shift in thinking, what was that for you?
So probably my favorite is a $2 billion corn processing company in Iowa. And they had been a very insurance-centric risk managed organization for a decade. And the CFO, of course, was sick and tired of always just hearing about insurance premium increases. And so they wanted to revisit how they were doing business. And they had a very capable director of risk management, but he was an insurance guy. And so every solution to everything was by more or different insurance, which is, you know, that's just like pouring your dollars into somebody else's profit margin. Because the tough part about insurance, and it's the same with workers' comp or any other, for a dollar you spend on insurance, you are lucky if you ever collect 40 cents back. It wasn't a game made for the client. And it's why Warren Buffett is worth however many billion dollars.
$7 trillion.
We started with this notion of materiality and discovered enormous insight from particularly the department heads and the VPs and then mid-level directors of safety and security. And it's interesting to go into the accounting department and start talking about fraud. And which, you know, in America is 6% of the gross domestic product. In our country, at a $20 trillion GDP, 6% is going someplace it's not supposed to go. It doesn't steal and rob from the economy, but it certainly causes ineffective management. So we discovered a number of different things. Now, one of the reasons these guys are one of my favorites is they process every element of a kernel of corn. They process 1,000 acres of corn a day. They have 2 4-story tall stills, which is a dream I had ever since I was in high school. And they produce 100,000 gallons of 160 proof pure corn alcohol every week. Load them on trains and it heads to Diageo, which is the major liquor producer in the UK. And it's the fortifier for Johnny Walker Red Label, which I'm a fan of. But it
in a theme here.
And then there's, you know, the different levels. So 160 proof, then you get down to 120, which is the base for cosmetics. And then you get down to 80, which is the base for ethanol gasoline. And then you get down to the dry stuff. You're finished with the wet stuff and they turn the dry stuff into cat litter. So literally there is no element. Well, and in the middle, there's animal feed. But the fun part about the risk story was they do this in a factory that is 20 feet below the waterline of the Mississippi River. And between them and the Mississippi River is an enormous human-built dike. And so you can only imagine that they think a lot of that pile of ground. Mm-hmm. Well, so the quick part of the story is that we were able to directly impact their risk performance by simple changes of methods and procedures and establishment of an interdepartmental governance structure to improve their operating performance by about $100 million a year. The very single largest element was they had no control over how they bought and sold and traded commodities. So can you imagine going, we've all heard of the Chicago Mercantile, commodity exchange, people transacting stuff like this, billions daily. And these guys had let their salespeople go negotiate contracts in the commodities market. And the CFO reflected that none of these commodities contracts are paying off for us. And so they simply put in place a three-person governance structure. Jim's all about governance, simply to review the proposals and approve them or not. That's right.
Okay.
They switched from negative 20 million to positive 20 million in 6 weeks.
Okay.
It didn't cost them anything, did it?
That's incredible.
Because they were already paying those people.
Yeah.
The other is, the major dike on the Mississippi River, they actually took their risk assessment to other manufacturers that operated in the same below the line or below the waterline delta. And that included Monsanto and the power company and a bunch of recreational facilities and all that kind of stuff. And they said, hey, we all could all agree that this thing ought to be expanded. None of us are going to be able to afford it ourselves. And if we rely on the federal government, that'll never go anywhere. So they actually put their heads together. They got the county involved. They got other stakeholders involved. And then they went to the Army Corps of Engineers who said, pretty good thinking. We'll fund half. How about you guys? And of course, the you guys was, sure, we'll fund our half. And it's under construction as we speak. Now, that's taken 4 or 5 years to get done, but it all hubbed out of this notion of proactively managing risk and understanding that we spend all these dollars. If you go to a CFO and ask them how much they're spending on risk, the only answer he or she can give you is the insurance premiums. But we spend a lot of other money. We spend money on your company's products. We spend money on human talent. We spend money on training. And so those dollars ought to produce a return, just like you'd expect a sales force to produce a return or the manufacturing product line to produce a return. And so that's probably the key change in thinking that I established 20 years ago with one of the cable companies here in the country who was ridiculously out of control in terms of risk.
Well, what I heard in that story, what I thought was really profound, was there's two parts of working together. And like, we kind of talked a lot about these silos, and then you put people together and the outcome was outstanding. And then they did it again, where all these folks got together and they created a change. So that's pretty beautiful.
Well, and the neat thing is that it's compounding. So you get this thing started and they have a success. And of course, somebody's going to celebrate this success. But you keep looking for other risks that I call emerging risks. And the thing that is profound today is risk is coming at us at a velocity and a volume larger than we've ever experienced. You pick up the newspaper on any given day, and there are more risk-oriented subjects than most humans can absorb. And velocity is probably the biggest one. They're just coming fast and dynamically, and some are internal and many are external. McKinsey just released a study, which I probably ought to send to you and Tom, of 1,000 CEOs who are finally beginning to risk that they need. They're beginning to realize that they need to be the chief risk officer.
Oh, wow. This is really interesting. So there needs to be a shift in terms of risk and and how people think about it. But I think the biggest takeaway for me is that that safety and risk and all the and all of these other departments are working together.
Yes.
There's this kind of togetherness instead of these silos, right?
The biggest and, risk, the biggest risk is the silos.
Yes, exactly. So if you were to give a safety director some advice on how to approach, you know, walking into this new kind of risk thought process, what would that be?
Identify his or her peers in all of the organization's silos and make best friends and invite them to the conversation. Often that group of people is waiting for somebody else to take the lead. So the prime advice is you take the lead until somebody tells you to get out.
Isn't that the truth? Ask for forgiveness, right?
Well, and, you know, I mean, I spent my whole career starting with the old Bell system, and everything we were about was safety. First week on the job was learning how to climb a telephone pole in Seattle, Washington, and throw a football from one telephone pole to another. It was really exciting.
Get out of here.
Yeah, for an engineering graduate. But from that moment forward, we cared about safety for all the measurable reasons that people measure. Nobody ever talked about the cost. And until I became a chief risk officer for a cable company and tried to, I mean, the story about the cable folks is that they're kind of wild.
It's frozen.
They make so much money, they don't have to care about risk. And in order to try to maintain any support from the C-suite, I had to build this financial story. That we would take those dollars that were in my budget basically, and we would produce a return. And that eventually produced $120 million a year in cash. And the majority of that came out of safety improvement, fraud reduction, and converting non-paying customers into paying customers.
Very insightful. I appreciate you very much. And tell us where everyone can find you. If they just think that I just have to get to know Jim and I need to know everything he knows, where can they find you?
Well, so our website is, of course, www.integratedrisksolutions.com. And there's a blog associated with that too. I produce a quarterly client advisory that tries to bring all of the exciting new stuff to the heads of about 800 readers. I'm on the Risk and Insurance Management Society website. Anybody who Googles Integrated Risk Management Solutions will find us via the web. And then, of course, interestingly enough, you know, we can always rely on the good old telephone.
What?
Which is 303-795-9754.
You know, I made some phone calls this week and it was odd. You know, I was like, I can do this. Yes, I can make phone calls. It was, I mean, I was really nervous. Like, you know, it was so dumb, but it is.
So I was at an Elevate Ethics program last night at University of Denver, which I've been part of for a long, long time, because believe it or not, ethics is one of the fundamentals of managing risk. And so they actually have a program that associates their business school and law school together. The people I was visiting with, I said, I think we're all going to have to go back to school and learn our social skills again.
You're not wrong. I mean, my kids, it's unbelievable. Like, my parents will call and they do this. You know, and I'm like, just put it to your ear. They're not on FaceTime. And they're like, what do I do? They can't figure it out. It's,
right.
Yeah. It's okay. I decided a long time ago that one of my main features as a parent was to teach them how to shake a hand and look somebody in the eye. And I was like, I'm going to get this right, you know, because that's something that my dad was very clear with me on.
So how are you doing?
Oh, it's like, I've got four of them. Two of them are like killing it. And the other one, he's just says, I'm shy. And I was like, well, you're going to have to learn how to do this. So.
Yeah. Well, she can practice on you.
Do it. You know, you're right. I just, you know, and but I have to have them practice because they can't be, you know, it has to be a certain kind of movement, a certain kind of squeeze and look somebody in the eye. I mean, it's all very sophisticated.
Eye contact is everything.
It really is.
And be able to hear the sound coming out of your own voice, sure. Out of your own throat, how to say hello, how are you, whatever the common chats of the day might be. And more than anything, what to say when somebody asks them how they are.
This is true. Well, you know, I remember a long time ago, my friend was at the gym and he said, somebody asked me to, I asked somebody today how they were, and he told me, and he went on and on forever. And I was like, you asked him.
In other words, saying, you know, I really don't care, but how are you?
This is just a nicety. How are you?
That's don't right. Answer. Right. Well, that's good. That's so fine. Much. You know, we've got four as well, but they have now produced 18 grandkids. So we have more than enough little Blair talents running around.
Oh my gosh. Are they all in Colorado?
No, we got 10 of them here and 8 of them in Oregon.
Wow, you are so blessed.
We are. Every time there's another thing to go to. This morning at 10 o'clock, there was a dance recital for the 3-year-old.
I mean, you can just get an RV and that's all you do is just drive around.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But we got baseball games and we got performances and we got dancing stuff and they're all theater types and music types and athletes. And yes, we have more than enough fun to do.
I love it. Well, thank you.
It's good.
So much, Jim.
I
really appreciate your time. You've been very insightful. And I hope people contact you for all of your nerdy wisdom.
Thank you for listening to the Safety Pro Roundtable. If you're ready to see your safety program thrive by incorporating some easy-to-use safety software, we'd love to connect further. Head to sospice.com/podcast to learn more about how our top-notch EHS software can make your job easier, safer, and your company more profitable. Again, that is sospice.com/podcast, or you can find the link in the show notes of this episode. We will see you soon.